sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
There's clues and indicators as well. So if you're reading something or listening to somebody give advice and you look at their career arc or lack thereof, that tells a story and gives a clue and an indication of, does this person's advice really work? So I'm not going to take cold calling advice from somebody who's had 6 inside sales jobs in the last 4 years. That's not an indication to me that they're very good at cold calling and they should probably keep their mouth shut. People need to dig around a little bit, not a ton, but just a real quick hunt and peck, like, okay, should I be listening to what Andy has to say? Like, is he actually even moderately successful and good at what he does?
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Well, that was Scott Lees. Scott's an author, podcast host, sales consultant, and much, much more. And in our conversation today, Scott and I talk about his new book, More Than a Number, The Modern VP Sales Playbook. Now, first of all, we get into why CEOs and founders have no idea how to support sales VPs and why VPs of sales are so passive in the face of the unreasonable expectations that are set for them and why they don't push back against them. We also dive into how sales VPs can break this vicious cycle of short job tenures and work to shape and manage the expectations about their performance. We also get into the playbooks that VPs need to develop in order to nurture the development of their team's performance and how VPs can help their sellers become better people in order to become better salespeople. Now, I always enjoy talking with Scott, so we dig into all of this and much, much more. But before we get to Scott, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could leave us a review, let us know how we're doing. So thank you for that. All right, let's jump into it. Scott, welcome back to the show.
What's up, Andy? Glad to be back.
It's good to have you. Good to have you. So what's new in Scott Lees world? Besides, you're incredibly busy with everything you're doing with your Thursday night deals, you're going to Costa Rica again soon?
Yeah, in November, we're, Richard Harris and I have a couple surf and sales sessions back-to-back. It's the first time I've ever done any back-to-back, so we're going to be in November. We're going to be in Costa Rica the whole month of November. And then in October, Amy Volos and I are taking Thursday night sales on the road, and we'll be in Las Vegas October 15th to October 17th for a Thursday night sales live mini conference / event party thing. So got some excellent stuff coming up. Yeah.
Excellent. Gosh. Everybody's doing such fun stuff. That's very cool. I like that.
Well, you know, we've been deprived for a while, and so we're just kind of going for it.
Yeah. Well, and so not worried about Delta variant popping up and spoiling the fun, or?
No, absolutely worried about it, for sure. Yeah. 100% worried. I mean, I'm immunocompromised and whatnot. I actually just a couple of days ago got my booster shot because I get access to it early. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, doing all I can, but you know, calculated risks, I suppose, right?
So Yeah, I mean, if you're triple vaxxed at this point, then you're probably in pretty good shape.
Should hope so. Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. But I'm tired of being locked inside. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, I'm in my Manhattan location, the month of August, basically. And you haven't actually gone inside restaurants deep, but we've been eating outside, which has been nice to actually go out and serve, be among people again. And it's,
I'm sure. Yeah. I haven't even done that. See, we each have our own calculated risks. So if I'm going to go somewhere, I guess I've decided I'm going to go big. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Costa Rica. Yeah. So you're gonna be able to surf, obviously. So
yeah, you know, nice. Small town, and Surf and Sails is only 20 of us at a time, right? So it's not like a big, huge crowd. And the houses that we rent, all the trainings that we do are all outside anyways, even before COVID. So, you know, it's a vax mandatory event. And, you know, it has risks, sure, but, we're gonna go for it and keep our fingers crossed that it works out.
Yeah, that sounds very exciting. So, one of the things I'm going to talk with you about is we're not going to make, I said, dive as deeply personal as we did the last time you were here, but you've written some things I post on LinkedIn, which I really liked. And there's one you're talking about. Don't be silenced. You remember that one? Don't let the powers that be silence you. Don't let the people you work for silence you. So I'll read the whole thing. Don't be silenced. Don't let the powers that be silence you. Don't let the people you work for silence you. Don't let your family silence you. Don't let your partner silence you. Hard to string those all together. You deserve to be heard, and you never know who needs to hear your message at exactly that moment in time. You never know who you may help. So what was the motivation behind that?
I think, just trying to encourage people to find their own voice and speak up and, maybe not be taken advantage of or trampled upon or pushed to the side in ways that they maybe have before. Some of that has to do with, putting content out there. There's a lot of companies, like it or not, there's a lot of companies who still try to suppress employee activity on sites like LinkedIn. And they think that they own it and control it. And, they'd love for you and I to just post the latest blog that the company wrote or the latest fundraising and, not speak up about life as a SDR or life as a VP of sales, that kind of thing. I have a really good friend that I won't out right now, but I hired her years ago and I thought she was like very unique. Unique style, unique personality. And I really like kind of leaned in and encouraged her saying like, you should start producing a lot of content and put it out there. And in the department that you're in and the work that you do, there's not a lot of people. And, she's like, fairly influential on LinkedIn now. And I'm super proud of her. And I had been having a conversation with her. So just like a confluence of those kind of events, and coupling that with what I perceive to be a massive shift in the power dynamics of the workplace. It's sort of like, well, now is a good time as any for, the people to kind of rise up and take their power, so to speak.
Yeah. And I think that as I read that, I extended that further because I think that for me, sales in general seems to be a more oppressive environment than it was, 20, 30 years ago when I was getting started, in that sellers seem to have a lot less autonomy about how they operate their business as sellers. And so when I was reading that, I was sort of reading that into it as well.
Speak up.
I mean, there's not just one way to sell.
Yeah. No, that's a very good point and super interesting. I can't proclaim that was the inspiration behind what I wrote, but it makes a ton of sense. I mean, if you think about kind of very restrictive sales scripts, not that there's anything wrong with sales scripts, but you and I are different. Our lives have been different. Our personalities are different. So the way I might tell a story is going to be a little bit different than the way you tell a story, as it should be. Or the cadences that people run and the emails that people send. an email that comes from you that performs really well might read super off brand for me, and people read it and be like, the heck, Scott, what got into Scott? Like, that doesn't make any sense, or vice versa, right?
Or vice versa, because they're vice versa, yeah, for sure.
So, you know, I can see that as automation has become more and more prevalent, and people are trying to find different ways to scale. You know, some of the we talk a lot about personalization in our outreach to others, but personalization in what we're allowed to do as sellers has maybe never been more oppressed, I think is the word that you use.
Yeah.
It's a really good point.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a initial tendency when you say, look, we've got some of these, you know, automation tools like Ring DNA cells, you know, conversational intelligence, that in the wrong hands, it's used to try to make everybody into a clone of some, you know, mythical top performer. When really the goal is, let's use these tools to help you become the best version of you, which is not going to be the same as the best version of Scott or best version of me. But, you know, I see the tendency is people just want to, I just want to cookie cutter this, as opposed to let me devote the time as a manager and as a leader to help my people become the best version of themselves and give them agency over the choices they make about how to sell.
Yeah. Yeah. I have so many examples of this. I'm thinking of one right now where somebody was asking me last night on Thursday Night Sales, actually, somebody was asking about, you know, what's like a good creative question in an interview process that I could ask a hiring manager. And I told a story about how when I was at Qualia, I had been there for about 2.5 years, and this candidate came in and they said to me, hey, I looked at your background, and you always leave right around year three, between 2.5 years and 3 years. You've been here 2.5 years so far. Part of the reason I would come work here is so I could work with you and learn from you. And I'm super worried about you leaving. So are you like about to leave? And I was like, holy shit, that's like the best question I think somebody has ever asked me in an interview, right? Put me on the spot. Yeah. And you know, I told them what my response was, and so I told that story, and this person on Thursday Night Sales was like, yeah, I tried that question. You told me that, or I heard you say that, you know, in a past interview or whatever. And Amy Volas immediately chimed in, and she's like, no, that's the problem. Don't ask the same question Scott did or the candidate did of Scott. Like, you're in a totally different scenario, totally different person, totally different situation. Like, the point is, that story hopefully kickstart some creative juices that allows you to think of something creative that is meaningful to you or that particular hiring manager, right?
Right.
And that's, you know, one of the goofs that maybe people make there.
Yeah. Well, it gets back to this idea is that, again, as an individual contributor or individual in any role, and my belief is the highest level of evolution for you that you can aspire to is to become the best version of you. And so you take your inspiration from other people and you experiment with it and you make it yours, right? The thing that's most aligned with who you are as an individual and as a human being, and that will necessarily be different than it will be for other people. And that's okay. But I see in the hands of inexperienced managers that this inclination is sort of being suppressed in the name of consistency.
Yeah.
And consistency is, you know, another word for mediocrity.
And another word for control. Managers are potentially grasping for more control than ever right now as they're still adjusting to remote leadership, remote onboarding and things like that. But you're right. Like, the way you sell is going to be different than the way I sell. Like, I could take whatever your perfect like pitch is, and I could listen to it and hear the tone. And again, if I delivered it that way, it might be just like completely flat. It just might not work. And the way that I sell, you know, might be very different for you and be like, oh my gosh, this is like super awkward and uncomfortable. I can't make it work. But you borrow bits and pieces from different people, and eventually you come up with your own. It's similar to like the evolution of music. Like you can listen to a band today and you're like, okay, there's elements mm-hmm. of a rock band that you could like, okay, it's obviously rooted in blues. There's a little bit of this influence. There's a little bit of that influence, right? But the band is like uniquely their own, and they're mm-hmm. really good, and they're super successful. They've got hits and whatnot, right? But it's not like, oh, this is exactly of Chuck Berry from like 1959, right? Like, no, it doesn't work like that, right?
Yeah, well, I was having a similar conversation with somebody in a related, which we'll topic, I guess we'll explore, is that he was, and he's not the only one. I've had this conversation with other people, sort of criticizing things they see on LinkedIn, right? Oh gosh, there's such bad advice that's out there. And admittedly, from my perspective, I see stuff there that all the time that I think, well, that's never going to work except by accident. But maybe it does work for somebody, right? And, you know, the people just, they need to read widely and get all these influences and, you know, just like listening to a ton of different music if you want to be a musician. Yeah. And soak it in, and there's going to be good and there's going to be bad, and you're going to learn to filter what's good from the bad. And we don't need to tell you what's good sales advice. Try it. If it doesn't work for you, then it's not good for you.
Well, that's the key point right there. And there's clues and indicators as well, right? So if you're reading something or listening to somebody give advice, and you look at their career arc or lack thereof, that tells a story and gives a clue and an indication mm-hmm. of, does this person's advice really work? So I'm not going to take cold calling advice from somebody who's had 6 inside sales jobs in the last 4 years. That's not an indication to me that they're very good at cold calling and they should probably mm-hmm. keep their mouth shut. I'm not going to take advice from somebody on scaling sales organizations and being a VP of sales who's done it 0 times so far, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And people need to dig around a little bit, not a ton, but just a real quick hunt and peck, like, okay, should I be listening to what Andy has to say? Like, is he actually even moderately successful and good at what he does? Okay, he is. So, okay, now maybe I'll try this.
Moderate.
Now I'll try this. Now I'll try this approach. Now I'll try these right. tips on, you know, selling, you know, from a human perspective, or these tips on like how to build a good podcast and all these things, right? And if it works for me, great. And if it doesn't, I'm either doing it wrong and need a little bit more advice and context so I can improve upon it, so I can nail Andy's approach, or after I try that, it still doesn't work. It's just like, that's not me. That's not going to work for me. Right. And so I can let that one go without disparaging Andy, but I can let that approach go and say, hey, that works for him and other people like him. That one doesn't work for me. Now I'll try to align with, you know, Scott. Maybe Scott's approach will work for me. And again, that's why you think you just pluck little pieces, bits and things, little bit of influences here and there and everywhere. And the best people, to your point, you know, they ultimately become the best version of themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I like to say if there's sale, 3 million B2B sellers in the United States, there's 3 million different unique sales methodologies and personal sales processes that people are using, and that's fine. We should encourage more people to have their own process and to become the best version of themselves.
It's fine in so long as the 3 million are all doing well and moderately successful. Well, if some of those 3 million are really bad and not succeeding at all, those ones maybe we could drop, no?
Yeah, but I'd say they maybe haven't become the best version of themselves.
Fair enough. They haven't got there yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So they need support to do that, which is another issue. And we'll get into it in a second because we're going to talk about your new book. But one other thing I wanted to talk about, another post you'd written about is you'd written one about you're going to lose the talent war if you mandate folks back into the office. So tell us about that one.
Well, I feel really strongly about this, and mm-hmm. you know, whether I'm right or wrong, I suppose remains to be seen. But I'm seeing it and witnessing it all day, every day from the front lines. You know, the advisory work that I do is with early stage startups in particular. So you're talking about companies who are playing in the like 0 to 50 million ARR kind of range. Okay. I've got employees who are, you know, juggling different opportunities, asking, you know, what do you know about this company? Who should I go interview with? What place should I take? And I've got companies that I work for or who ask me for advice. They're like, how do I secure Andy's talents? What kind of offer do you think I should make? And all this kind of stuff. You can run the math, regardless of where you live, and figure out like how much you're spending every day by going into the office. You're talking gas money, bridge toll, food that you're eating that's more expensive when you're eating out, wear and tear on your car. You get a flat tire here. You got to change your oil more often, get into a fucking accident, right? And that doesn't even pull into consideration, you know, extra time you have. You said you went for a walk this morning before we started recording. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not going for a walk in the morning if I got to commute somewhere. I'm not an early riser anymore like I used to be. So that's out the window. So my dogs are not getting the exercise. I'm not getting the exercise. It's not happening. Right. I'm not home as much to be there for my kids when my kids get home from school. I can't take them to practice. I miss practices. I miss early evening games and events, after school things. Why are people going to give all of that up? Why?
Mm-hmm.
They've already demonstrated over the last year and a half plus that they can do their job remotely from home. And in many cases, do it better. There are so many companies I know of whose growth has gone exponentially through the roof, you know, during COVID. And you know, you factor in from the company perspective, like, how are you going to hire people only in Austin or only in New York for these particular roles? You're limiting your talent pool so much, especially like really kind of specialized roles. Like, I hope this doesn't come across the wrong way, but like I get asked to kind of come out of retirement a lot. People are looking for a CRO, VP of sales, you know, in Austin. And I'm like, no, I don't, you know, I'm not into it. And I do a lot of different math and explanations with them, what's going on in my life. And like, well, who else do you know? And I'm like, in Austin or anywhere? Because there's not that many people just in Austin. But if you open the net that I'm casting up to everywhere, even just everywhere in North America, now it's a lot easier for me to put a lot of people in front of you. So I just think that the workforce has more choices and more power than they've ever had before. I think they have recognized it and are standing up for themselves and saying, no, I don't want that kind of life anymore. I want to walk my kids to school in the morning. I want to, you know, take them to practice and go to their games. I don't want to commute back and forth. I don't want to be around a bunch of people. I actually do my best work more in a alone setting. At the very least, I think you can provide people the opportunity to go into an office for those people who want to take that opportunity. But to try to mandate somebody to go back into the office 5 days a week, I don't see how that's going to fly. We thought we were coming out of the COVID situation. Now you got the Delta variant situation that's ripping through the country and getting vaccinated people sick as well. How can you in good conscience say, hey, Andy, I need you to come to the office 5 days a week right now? I don't understand that. I just don't at all. And how long is this going to go on? We don't know. So I just think it's a massive misstep. And I think more and more people are going to be accustomed and successful and happy in this remote kind of environment. I think companies are just going to lose out on talent. They really are. They're not going to be able to pull the A plus kind of talent, and the A plus kind of talent is going to have their pick of the litter. And those companies that are more progressive with their views on this stuff are going to win. They're going to win those talent wars.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, yeah, the future is unknowable, but you know, the flexibility you have as sellers in particular, it was always a job that we sort of got into somewhat for the flexibility.
Sure.
I mean, when I was getting into sales, sort of the MO was, well, hey, Yeah, if you take care of your quota by by Wednesday.
Right, yeah, get out of here. Go,
get out of here, right?
Yeah.
And that changed over time. But it was that type of thing. It's, you know, we bring people into sales thinking, yeah, if you've got this flexibility about how to operate this business. Yeah, I bought into the whole thing when I first joined sales is I was the CEO of my territory, right? And that was empowering, right? That was motivating to be able to do that and to handle it the way I wanted. Yeah, I had to go into an office, but basically I was in the field most days for a long time. So I had a lot of flexibility there as well.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I think sellers sort of get into sales for in part for the flexibility. And if you try to take that away, I think that's going to be very problematic. I think I'm interested in your take, though, is because there's been increasing amounts written recently about, are we in danger of creating sort of a two-tier system of employees where those that do come into the office more frequently benefit because of FaceTime with the people that are making decisions and so on?
I mean, we already have multi-tiered systems of employment and preference and privilege. I mean, let's be clear about that. So maybe it's just evolving a little bit, but I think that that's fine. I think people, that's part of the decision-making process. You know, if you said to me, hey, if you go into the office 5 days a week, you have more opportunity to move up into the C-suite. I would gauge that and the benefits of that versus the benefits of me staying remote. And some people will choose to go in, more power to them. Some people will choose to stay remote, more power to them. But the option and the flexibility to have a choice there, I don't know that I have a big problem with that. And by the way, that only works if people break the union, so to speak, right? If people cross the picket line. I mean, that only works if people actually say, okay, yes, I'm willing to go into the office 5 days a week because then I can, you know, move up the ranks faster. Will that happen? Maybe.
Sure.
Probably. There's always people. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. But I think it will happen less and less and less. It happens now with satellite offices. How many times have you heard people say, well, Andy, if you really want to move up, you can't live in San Diego. You need to move to corporate in San Francisco.
Well, yeah. That first company I worked for years and years ago, that was the path.
So I don't know that it's that much different. And I think, again,
corporate was Detroit, though. So it's
a little less appealing than San Francisco, perhaps. So, yeah. But there you go. So it's no different, right? You made your choice to not move to Detroit. Some people will make their choice not to go into the office 5 days a week.
Well, I think that's a perfect point, right? Is regardless of the generation, there's always been choices to make. My father got promoted quite a bit and moved quite a bit early in his career because even with the sacrifices it took with the kids and have four kids and so on, that's the choice he wanted to make. But he had peers that didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And yeah, so they didn't, but they, not to say they were less successful or less fulfilled in their careers or whatever, it's just a different choice. And I agree with you. I think giving people that choice is, again, because gets back to this idea of giving people agency in their choices.
Yeah. And I think that people's eyes have been really opened in the last year and a half.
Sure.
And I think more and more people are going to be willing to say no. And I think that's the change that will force the hand. And that's how I see the talent war kind of, you know, shaping up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, you look sort of down the road, future of sales, it's like, I mean, do sellers really need to be actually employed by the companies they're selling for?
I don't know.
Once you break that bond with the office, it's like, well, so what is the nature of that employment agreement between a seller and a company they're representing?
Sure.
I mean, if you're not in the office.
Why do I have to work for one company at a time?
Well, that was the next question. Exactly. Why do I need to work for one company at a time?
I don't know. What if I could work for RingDNA and Outreach 4 hours a day each? Build a pipeline, hit my quota. Why is that wrong? If that was my choice. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it is. I think that I personally believe that's the future. Is that for at least for starting at the most top talent that, you know, has the most talent in demand or skills in demand. Why wouldn't you want to do that? I mean, as a manager, you're going to have to change your perspective about,
sure,
you know, what this person is doing for you. But if they're producing,
yeah,
grow up and get over it.
Yeah. And, you know, I've thought a lot about some of these kind of weird futuristic things like this. Like, how come they're not employment contracts like they are athletic contracts?
Oh, I thought my next career would be as an agent for sellers.
Yeah.
A talent agent. 100%.
You know how many people, you do know because you've thought about this already, but like, you know how many people are terrible at negotiating their own offers and don't know how to do it the right way? Right?
Yeah.
Would you pay a talent agent to help you land a new sales gig somewhere? Right? And they take a cut of it, but in doing so, they got you the best gig. They checked all the boxes. They got you more money than you'd get on your own. Is that a possibility?
Yeah.
I think so. If I'm going for a CRO role, why would I take a job that sort of says like, hey, we could terminate you, you know, at any time, and you have a 4-year vest on all your options and all that kind of stuff. Why would I take that gig over somebody who says to me, listen, you've been around a long time. I don't need to play games. I know you're not coming here to just like sit on your ass and hide out. We're going to pay you X amount guaranteed for the next 2 years, and all of your options, you know, vest in 2 years. You're not going to fire. We're not going to fire you. You know, you're not going to leave. Like this is a contract, like signing an NFL contract or an MLB contract or whatever. Which gig would I take?
Well, first of all, you'd want to be an NBA or Major League Baseball contract,
yeah, because they're guaranteed.
As opposed to NFL. You don't want to sign an NFL contract.
Okay. Bad example. Start with NBA and MLB.
That will, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think that the risk has always been completely on the part of the employee.
That's right.
And comparatively little on the part of the employer. Yes, there's a risk this person doesn't work out and so on.
Yes.
But for the person that over delivers on value.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a seller for a startup, and I've been in the situation myself, either as a individual contributor or even as a VP, and it's like, you know, we just closed this deal that enabled the company to go public. And I just made the investors and the founders tens of millions of dollars. And I just get a commission on that.
Right.
It's like, yeah, we're not paying people for the value that they're actually providing.
Yeah. I mean, you said it. All the risk has always been with the employee. And I just think that that's going to change. I think it is changing. And I think it's changed a little bit exponentially in the last, you know, 18 months because of the pandemic. And I, for one, am here. I'm here for that kind of revolution. And I hope it keeps going.
Well,
maybe it keeps going that way.
We'll start our agency. So if you're listening to this,
that's right,
you want to be represented.
Yeah.
Scott and Andy, we're opening our agency.
Yeah.
Give us a call.
Yeah. ScottandAndy.com.
Perfect. Works for me. I'm used to having my name second because I had an older brother, Scott. So yeah, you say Scott and Andy, just flows. It's perfect. Well, let's talk about your new book in the few minutes we have left. So tell us about it. What's it called? And we'll dive into a little of the topic.
Yeah, it's called More Than a Number, and it came out in June. It's my third book and kind of the conclusion to a mini trilogy, if you will. My first book was about kind of the mindset and how to get into sales and individual contributor selling philosophy. And my second book was about how to go from sales rep to sales manager. And this book, More Than a Number, is all about the life and times of a VP of sales, I'm trying to kind of highlight some of the good, bad, and ugly, and talk a little bit about how you get such a role, how you become good at it, and what some of those relationships look like up above. And, you know, just kind of trying to give people a little bit of a playbook and a guide, if you will, because there's not a lot of literature out there specifically targeted at, you know, VPs. And so I thought that there was a little bit of a gap in the market there. And considering that I've been a VP of sales at early stage startup 5 times, you know, felt like I might have a little bit to contribute and try to help out the greater sales community.
Yeah. And I think as I was reading it, there was sort of a sort of the counterbalance sort of comes out too, which is, it's okay to be an individual contributor as well. Everybody should want to be a VP of sales. If you're really successful at what you're doing and you think, oh gosh, maybe the next step is jumping into management or senior management. I can't tell you how many friends that I was with and so are lower levels of management, middle management, that just said, oh no, God, I just want to be a seller at this point. And that's okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as you know, I spent, a decent chunk up front at the beginning of the book kind of, trying to get people to ask those questions. Are you sure you want to do that? Yep. Here's what it's actually like. If you are not into this, maybe don't go down this path. If you are into this, okay, this might be the right path for you. And it's a big, big, painful miss for the person who takes it, like VP of sales role and doesn't enjoy it. And it's a big miss for the company that hires somebody who's not a good fit for it, right? So trying to kind of help out both sides a little bit.
Right. And I think one of the clear messages early on in the book is, look, sales is a lonely profession. And it's sort of you on an island. I mean, you have teammates and so on. But, at the end of the day, you sort of think of yourself as being, I'm the one out there doing this. And the picture you paint, which is absolutely true, is it doesn't get any less lonely as you scale the heights. Because, as you point out, if you're a VP of sales working for a CEO or COO, they're not going to support you in the way you want to be supported. They have no idea how to do it.
Yeah.
And on top of which, they lay these unreasonable expectations on you. And as you point out, people sort of know, the average tenure of a VP of sales or CRO is barely more than one complete business cycle.
That's right. That's right. And, that is something that I'm hoping we can change. There's a million different ways to try to change it. But, awareness is where it should start. Awareness that the role is that tenuous. Awareness of asking yourself the right questions of whether or not this is the right kind of role for you. Awareness of for a CEO and a founder of how to interview for, their VP of sales and make sure the person is set up for it. In particular, if it's a stretch VP and you're giving somebody their kind of first crack at it. So avoiding some of those mistakes from both sides, would lengthen, in theory, I think, if I'm any good at math, would lengthen the average tenure a little bit. And that's one particular place maybe we could move the needle a little bit. So I wanted to touch upon that, and I wanted to provide a little bit of guidance for people who are in the role. It's like, okay, here's the things that I think you should do when you're first getting started, right? It's like, learn your industry, learn your product inside and out. Set up, the sales pitch and the approach, figure out the strategy. What's the go-to-market? Where are you going to get the leads from? What's our sales process like? What's the competitive landscape look like? What are some of the common objections that we're going to run into? Who is our customer? Who are our prospects? What are their pain points? What do they love about our solution? What do they need from our solution that we don't have yet? All of this kind of stuff. I could go on and on and on. And I just tried to kind of spell it all out and give a little bit of guidance there. If you know anything about the books that I write and my style, I'm very much like get in and get out. I'm not trying to write a 1,000-page War and Peace novel on how to be a VP of sales. Okay. Number one.
And you have a quote in the book that says success comes from shrinking the delta between idea and action. So you're doing that with the way you write the book.
Yeah, I very much try to live that, and try to get in and get out. I think of it as like, right. Okay, you're in New York right now, okay? If you take like a 2.5-hour flight to Austin to come see me, you should be able to finish the book by the time you get there. That's how I think about it. It should be like a single flight, in and out, digest it, download it, and if you wanted to, pick it up again. I hope when your book comes out, for our friendship's sake, that your book is not 1,000 pages and I've just offended you.
No, it's 120 pages. 120 pages.
There you go. So we're kind of similar. I just can't do I just can't do the 1,000-page stuff, And this is like a primer and a teaser. but there's enough meat on the bone, I think, to be helpful. And if people want more, they reach out to me or they reach out to other people they know and kind of dive into that stuff. But I wanted to provide at least, a resource.
Yeah. So let me ask a question. So we have this issue with tenure, and this is particularly true in the tech business, right? 18 months. I don't know if it's true outside of tech or not, but if you're coming in as a VP, like I said, and you're thinking, gosh, I've got a way I want to do this. I got a vision for how I want this to unfold, or, the processes we want to use, or, I bring my team in. You really don't have time to do any of that, right? I mean, if the expectations are set in such a way that you're going to get bounced in 18 months if you don't hit these unreasonable expectations, what realistically should a new VP of sales do, or a VP of sales at a new, new assignment, let's say, not necessarily a new company? What should they be focused on? What's in your mind? What are the priorities? Because, that clock is ticking from day one, and the tendency would become, not to really disrupt things too much, but that's also not a winning situation.
Well, I can't tell if you're playing devil's advocate or you really believe that. So here's what I think. I think what you just described is the absolute trap that so many VPs fall into, where they look at that ticking clock and they're like, I don't have time to do all this other shit Scott was just talking about. I got to focus on what we're doing right now to close these deals so I can save my ass. And the irony is, when you approach it that way, you actually are more likely to fail and more likely to be out on the street in 18 months. The correct thing to do before you take the gig, the correct thing to do is be very upfront about what your approach is going to be. So, in particular, I'll focus on early stage companies because that's the majority of my experience. So if you're the CEO, this is an early stage company, you have 2-3 sellers, right? And you want to kind of take this to scale. If you're interviewing me, I'm going to be like, listen, the first 90 days, you should expect us to be flat or go down in revenue. That's part of my interview process. Part of me setting expectations. I'm like, what are you talking about? Why would I agree to that? Well, here's why. And I describe to them all the things that I need to do. I got to learn. I got to seek to understand. I got to recreate a bunch. I got to build. The first 90 days, all I'm going to be able to do is learn and build. And I haven't even been able to start executing yet. Okay. And then I've got a foundation in place. And now we go execute this playbook that we've just built. And, depending on the deal size and the complexity, what the sales cycle is, if it's a 90 to 120 day sales cycle, we'll know pretty quick whether this thing is at least working. I might not have a million deals come in, but I can see things progressing and progress and all that kind of stuff. If it's a longer sales cycle where it's 12 to 18 months, I've got one crack. I got one cycle and it better work. And if it doesn't, I'm gone. But I'm a big believer in laying the foundation, building that foundation to scale straight away. That's where you should spend your time. And when you get it right, now you're set up to continue forever. Otherwise, you're never going to have more time than you do right now. What are you going to do? Show up, ignore building all this stuff, and ignore codifying and turning everything that works for your sales machine into a system and just chase your tail trying to close deals forever? That's not going to work. You can't do that when you have a dozen sales reps, 25 sales reps, 200 sales reps. That doesn't work. Eventually, you have to hit the pause button and say, oh, shit, I got to go build all these things. I got to go build all these systems. I got to get everybody on the same page. You know how much harder it is to do that when you have 200 people as opposed to 3? So
let me ask a question.
Go ahead.
But let me ask a question. So assume that you take over an organization that has a large number of sellers, as you just talked about. And the pause button does need to be hit because it's just dysfunctional. But the board is pressuring the CEO. They're laying the hammer down on you. How's the VP of sales? What's that conversation like with the CEO to say, look, we need to hit a little bit of a reset here?
Well, I think that's the conversation. And I think you don't take the job. If you're the VP of sales, you don't take the job if the board and the CEO isn't the least bit on the same page as that.
Right.
I wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
I filter it out. And I think that my experience at least is like founders and the board, they get it. They know that, you know, whatever they were doing is not working, or they wouldn't have invited you. And the last person who was in the chair would still be there. So they know that some things need to change, right? How disruptive it's going to be depends. You know, I would, if there's 200 people there, I probably don't need to come in like a wrecking ball and just throw everything in the garbage and start from scratch. It's a lot more nuanced, right? I poke around. I take my time a little bit with how I tweak things, if I tweak certain things at all. If you're going in super early, they don't have nothing.
Yeah.
They have nothing. And so there's no risk at all. So I think if I'm going into a 200-person org, I go in a little bit more delicately, but I fight like hell to set the expectation that, yeah, things are going to be a little flat, maybe even go down a little bit for a while. But then I go in there a little bit more delicately, and I learn what's busted. And I try to make little change here, little change there, one at a time, rather than maybe ripping off the whole Band-Aid and blowing the whole thing up.
Yeah, I like the phrase you coined. Instead of YOLO, it's YORO.
Yeah, you only ramp once.
Right.
So you better get it right.
Yeah, better get it right. But also, to your point, which I 100% agree with, is you need to set the expectations when you're interviewing, and you need to use that time that you're given, if you've got that time. And don't be so anxious to become a VP of sales that you're going to just jump into any situation, including those where they're not going to give you the time.
That's right.
Because why set yourself up for immediate failure? I mean, you might think, you know, it's sort of like when, you know, two people get married and one of the partners thinks, well, person's not perfect, but I can change them. I know I can change them. And it doesn't usually work out very well that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've all heard, I think we all know how that goes.
Yeah. So it's a very similar situation. If you think you can change, yeah, that's not going to happen. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, Scott, well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yes. Always a lot of fun talking to you, Andy. Appreciate it.
So if people want to learn more about the book and connect with you, where should they do that?
All of my books are available on Amazon, probably the best place to go. And you can find me on LinkedIn, of course, but also every Thursday night, I host Thursday Night Sales. And you can find me at the Surf and Sales podcast, as well as the Surf and Sales events at surfandsales.com. And I even run events on Tuesdays now. I run my own Patreon community and do these couple hour long sales and leadership trainings. So I'm on Patreon. So you can find Scott Lease on Patreon if you're interested in that.
Oh, excellent. You're ubiquitous.
I'm a lot of places. I got my hands in a lot of cookie jars.
You do. That's great. Yeah. All right, Scott, a pleasure.
All right, Andy. Cheers.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. As always, I'm so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank my guest, Scott Lease, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. So thank you for that. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.